2 Kings 17:15, it says, they followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. This is a key observation in the final remarks made about the northern kingdom of Israel after the Assyrians wiped them out. It is a very powerful and insightful observation about human beings, really. Ralph Waldo Emerson made this observation about worship, and I've shared this before, but I think it's just, it's so dead on. He wrote, "The gods we worship write their names on our faces. Be sure of that. And a man will worship something. Have no doubt about that either. He may think that his tribute is paid in secret in the dark recesses of his heart, but it will come out. That which dominates will determine his life and character. Therefore, it behooves us to be careful what we worship, for what we are worshiping, we are becoming." We need to be careful about who or what we worship, because we are affected by what we worship. The object of our worship changes us. If we are worshiping anything other than the one true God, we are becoming less than what we are intended to be. We were made to worship God, and only as we are engaged in worship of the infinite, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-encompassing triune God who spoke the universe into existence are we fulfilling the destiny that we were created for. We are diminishing who we are and intended to be when we are worshiping anything other than the one true God. The observation that's made by the writer of the book of 2 Kings makes this same point. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. Who or what we worship is so vitally important that it's the subject of the first two commandments of the Ten Commandments. The first commandment, Exodus 23, says, "You shall have no other gods before me." There are to be no other gods, real or imagined, in our heart and life that compete with him as our one and only God. The Lord is the only one to be worshipped. And the second commandment is Exodus 24. It says, "You shall not make for yourselves an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." This commandment forbids both the making of idols that are false gods and the making of things to represent the true God. God has no physical form that we can see or touch. He doesn't want us making anything that represents him in a physical way. Further, nothing in creation is adequate to represent the infinite God. He's not like anything in the created universe. Anything we create would ultimately be a misrepresentation of him and diminish in our mind who he really is. The most accurate and complete expression of God that we have been given is Jesus Christ, the Son. Hebrews 1:3 says, "The Son, Jesus, is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being." John 1:18 says, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known," or revealed him to us. Well, throughout the books of 1 and 2 Kings, these many kings are not judged as good or bad based on their political prowess, their military victories, the wealth they accumulate, the power they wield, the fame and respect that they earn among their peer nations, or any of the other metrics that the secular world uses to measure us. Instead, these kings are evaluated on who they are. Worship. They're evaluated on who they worship, because who or what they worship affects the kind of person they are and how they live their life. Who or what we worship identifies who we trust in, who we pledge our allegiance to, who fulfills us, who gives us meaning and purpose and motivation in life, who sets the limits and parameters for how we live, where our joy comes from, who our hope is anchored in, who we give our control to. Well, last time, We looked at two kings of the southern kingdom of Judah, Amaziah and his son Azariah. Both of these men, they started out well, as you might remember, but they didn't end well for the same underlying reason. Their pride led them to do foolish things and refuse to listen to advice that could have redirected their path. In the end, their pride led to their destruction and their downfall. Today, we're going to look at the last kings of the northern kingdom of Israel and its final demise. It's really kind of a downbeat if you came here to, have this, uplifting, sunny message. I didn't write the book. Okay. And not every chapter is full of sunshine. Some chapters are just hard truth, and this is one of those. Flipping your Bible over to 2 Kings chapter 14, and we're picking the story up in verse 23. We skipped over Jeroboam 2 last time. He is the king of Israel during the time Amaziah and Azariah are kings of Judah. Verse 23, it says, in the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord and did not turn away from any of the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. That's Jeroboam 1. We're talking about Jeroboam 2 here, which he had caused Israel to commit. He was the one who restored the boundaries of Israel from Lebo Hamath to the Dead Sea in accordance with the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, spoken through his servant Jonah, son of Amittai, the prophet from Gath-Hepher. Jeroboam II is the last major king of the northern kingdom of Israel. There will be six kings that follow him. And we'll look at all of those today, but they will all be minor in comparison to the length of his reign and what he accomplished. He reigned for 41 years, the longest of any king of the northern kingdom. Spiritually, Jeroboam, quote, did evil in the eyes of the Lord, continuing in the footsteps of his predecessors and following the counterfeit religion that the first Jeroboam had established and led Israel astray with. Secular history considers Jeroboam II to have been Israel's greatest king. Militarily, he reestablished the nation's boundaries to what they were during the days of Solomon, making Israel the largest country on the eastern Mediterranean coast during his reign. The Assyrians had badly crippled Israel's longstanding enemy, Aram, making them an easy takeover for Israel under Jeroboam II, and he took full advantage of that, extending Israel's boundaries and emptying Aram's coffers into Israel's treasuries. Economically, the country was tremendously wealthy during his reign. It was a golden age for Israel. Sadly, this great prosperity did not lead Israel back to the Lord any more than their days of suffering and poverty had under other kings. Neither plenty nor want moved the heart of the people of Israel back to the Lord. And there's a lesson in that for us, isn't there? The thought is sometimes expressed, that, and I've heard people say this kind of thing, if the Lord would bless me with a better job, with a husband, with a wife, with children, with great wealth, with a healing, and so on, then I would believe and I would follow. Evidence does not support that claim. If our heart can't be drawn to the Lord now in the situation we're in, it's doubtful that a change in our circumstances is going to make much of a difference. Come to the Lord now, just as you are in the situation you're in. Give him your heart. Don't wait for some change in your circumstances. That is an excuse that we tell ourselves to continue doing what we're doing rather than making the changes that we know we should make. An interesting side note here, the Jonah that's mentioned here in verse 25, this is that same Jonah that some of you are kind of wondering that, yeah, that same Jonah who got swallowed by the giant sea creature and who God sent to preach to the people in the great Assyrian city of Nineveh. This is an interesting crossover between the book of Jonah and the book of 2 Kings. Two other prophets with books in the Bible who were also active and spoke during Jeroboam II's reign is Amos and Hosea. During this spiritually empty time under his reign, the Lord sends several of his messengers to speak to the people, to try to get them to turn from their sins and come back to him. Sadly, his messengers were not listened to. We'll turn over now to 2 Kings 15, verse 8. We're skipping over Kings of Judah accounts. And verse 8, 2 Kings 15, it says, in the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Zechariah, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 6 months. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, as his predecessors had done. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. Shalom, son of Jabesh, conspired against Zechariah. He attacked him in front of the people, assassinated him, and succeeded him as king. So Jeroboam is succeeded by his son Zechariah, and the disintegration of the nation begins speeding toward its final annihilation at this point. Just as the leadership of Israel is filled with all of this chaos and turmoil, conspiracy, assassinations, violence of every kind, the Assyrians become this terrifying, conquering menace in the region and will be the agent that is used to bring an end to the northern kingdom of Israel. The Lord's judgment is coming upon Israel after 200 years of wicked rebellion where they continually refused his repeated appeals to reconcile with him. Zechariah reigns only 6 months before he's assassinated by this man named Shalom. The only notable thing about Zechariah's reign is that it serves as the fulfillment of the Lord's promise that he had made to Jehu back in 2 Kings 10, verse 30, where God told Jehu that his descendants would sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation. And Zechariah is the fourth generation. This highlights not the faithfulness of Israel or Jehu or any of the other kings of Israel, but it highlights the faithfulness of the Lord. He kept his promise to Jehu, even though Jehu and his descendants were wicked men who did evil in the eyes of the Lord. None of these men served as king because they deserved it, but because the Lord was keeping his promise. And you know the same is true for each of us about our salvation. We're not being saved because we deserve it, but because the Lord is keeping his promise to us that he's made through Jesus Christ. Amen. Skip to verse 13 of chapter 15. It says, Shalom, son of Jabesh, the one who assassinated the previous king, he became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah, and he reigned in Samaria 1 month. Then Menahem, son of Gadi, went from Tirzah up to Samaria. He attacked Shalom, son of Jabesh, in Samaria, assassinated him, and succeeded him as king. You might remember Uzziah is Azariah, same guy. He goes by those two different names. Shalom reigns for 1 month before he's assassinated by this man named Menahem. Menahem is an extremely violent person, marking a new low in the leadership of Israel. In verse 16, it says, at that time, Menahem, starting out from Tirzah, attacked Tifsa and everyone in the city and its vicinity because they refused to open their gates. He sacked Tifsa and ripped open all the pregnant women. It's difficult to find words to describe the degradation of Israelite society with its leaders like this coming to the forefront. It's a disturbing, tragic time. 2 Kings 17:15 says they followed worthless idols and they themselves became worthless. Skip down to verse 17 of this chapter. It says, in the 39th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Menahem, son of Gadi, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria 10 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. During his entire reign, he did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. Then Pul, king of Assyria, invaded the land, and Menahem gave him 1,000 talents of silver to gain his support and strengthen his own hold on the kingdom. Menahem exacted this money from Israel. Every wealthy person had to contribute 50 shekels of silver to be given to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria withdrew and stayed in the land no longer. So Israel, paying tribute to Assyria, only whets Assyria's appetite and shows that Israel doesn't have the strength or the will to stand up to them. Assyria is going to come knocking again very soon. Skip to verse 23. In the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, son of Menahem, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 2 years. Pekahiah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. This sounds like a broken record, doesn't it? One of his chief officers, Pekah, son of Remaliah, conspired against him, taking 50 men of Gilead with him. He assassinated Pekahiah, along with Argob and Ariah, in the citadel of the royal palace of Samaria. So Pekah killed Pekahiah and succeeded him as king. Again, it sounds like a broken record. Pekahiah is another failed leader who is assassinated by another greedy, power-hungry person who will also prove to be an awful leader. Pekah. So in verse 27, in the 52nd year of Azariah, son of Judah, Pekah, son of Remaliah, became king in Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 20 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. And Pekah, he reigned for 20 years before he was assassinated by a man named Hoshea, who succeeded him as king. During Pekah's reign, the Assyrians invaded Israel again and took most of its northern territory and deported the best and the brightest of the people to the Assyrian Empire. It's a pleasant story. Skip to 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 1 now. Because again, we're skipping over the kings of Judah, focusing on Israel this morning. In verse 1, it says, in the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, son of Elah, became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, but not like the kings of Israel who preceded him. Hoshea is the last king of the northern kingdom of Israel. His reign lasted 9 years before the Assyrians put an end to it. Hoshea had been a vassal of the Assyrians, paying them tribute, serving their interests. But Hoshea secretly sought an alliance with the king of Egypt to overthrow Assyrian rule. The Assyrians discovered what Hoshea was doing, and they brought the full force of the Assyrian army down on Israel. They laid siege to the capital city of Samaria, destroying it. They put Hoshea in prison. They deported the people of Israel to other locations within the Assyrian Empire. They resettled Israel with people brought in from other areas of their empire, just kind of swapping people out. The northern kingdom of Israel is no more, never to emerge again. The year is 722 BC. This is the end of the northern kingdom of Israel and its 10 tribes. Beginning in verse 7 of 2 Kings 17, the author of Kings explains why this terrible fate happened to Israel. Verse 7, it says, "All this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh of Egypt. They worshipped other gods and followed the practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before them, as well as the practices that the kings of Israel had introduced. Israel owed their very existence to the Lord. Had the Lord not delivered them from slavery in Egypt, they would not have survived and even been a people at this point. They repay the Lord by forsaking him. They worship the gods of the peoples that the Lord drove out of Canaan to create a home for them and created their own counterfeit religions and gods to worship. As I mentioned at the beginning of our study, who and what we worship determines our fate, who we are and who we are becoming. Verse 9 says, the Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. From watchtower to fortified city, they built themselves high places in all their towns. They set up sacred stones and Asherah poles on every high place and under every spreading tree. At every high place they burned incense, as the nations whom the Lord had driven out before them had done. They did wicked things and aroused the Lord's anger. They worshipped idols, though the Lord had told them, 'You shall not do this.' The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers, 'Turn from your evil ways, observe my commands and decrees, in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your ancestors to obey, and that I delivered to you through my servants the prophets.'" But verse 14, "But they would not listen, and were as stiff-necked as their ancestors, who did not trust in the Lord their God. They rejected his decrees and the covenant he had made with their ancestors and the statutes he had warned them to keep. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. They imitated the nations around them, although the Lord had ordered them, 'Do not do as they do.' They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless." Again, we are affected by what we worship, becoming like what we worship. If we worship worthless and foolish things, we will become like those things. If we worship that which is noble and holy and beautiful, then we become noble and holy and beautiful. Verse 16, "They forsook all the commands of the Lord their God and made for themselves two idols cast in the shape of calves and in the Asherah pole." This is a direct reference to what Jeroboam had started in the northern kingdom. "They bowed down to all the starry hosts and they worshiped Baal, recounting all of the wicked things that the kings in the north have done. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters in the fire. They practiced divination and sought omens and sold themselves to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing his anger." The breaking of the first two commandments, which are about who we worship, leads to the breaking of the other commandments and the breakdown of our moral and social foundations. Who or what we worship, it forms the foundation of our life, including our morals and our society. And this is a description of what happened to these people when they broke those first two commandments. And then the rest of their society literally crumbles under them. Verse 18, "So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. Only the tribe of Judah was left. And even Judah did not keep the commands of the Lord their God. They followed the practices Israel had introduced. Therefore, the Lord rejected all the people of Israel He afflicted them and gave them into the hands of plunderers until he thrust them from his presence. When he tore Israel away from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, son of Nebat, their king. Jeroboam enticed Israel away from following the Lord and caused them to commit a great sin. The Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until the Lord removed them from his presence, as he had warned through all his servants, the prophets. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they are still there. The Lord warned the people many times in many different ways. He attempted to get their attention and draw them back to himself many times in many different ways. It was all refused and ignored by them. Anyone who questions the fairness of what happened to the people of Israel has to turn a blind eye to the historical account of all that the Lord did for these people. The Lord waited some 200 years for the reign of from the reign of Jeroboam to his establishment of that counterfeit religion, to the Assyrians finally coming in and just destroying the nation. It was a 200-year waiting period. The people of Judah are now left to ponder the fate of their northern brothers and sisters. Will they learn? Will they get the message? Ultimately, no. They will not, unfortunately. In closing, 2 Kings 17:15, they followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. Who or what are we worshiping? Who are we giving our allegiance to? Who is the most important thing in our life? Who gives our life joy and purpose? Who gives us worth? Who is the foundation that our life rests on? Is it the infinitely glorious Lord Jesus Christ, who gives our life infinite worth, fills us with unquenchable joy, gives us a foundation of peace and of a moral compass to direct our path and a future of hope? Or have we chosen to follow worthless things that diminish us and make us less than what the Lord intends for us to be and to become? This is the question that is laid before us as we ponder the fate of these people. Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 10:11, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the culmination of the ages has come.